Drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Simple minds don't forget about me. You know, that classic moment at the end of The Breakfast Club as Bender pumps his fist into the air. Eddie Vedder's soulful hard sun underpins the full emotional romp in the film adaptation of Into the Wild. And David Bowie's Heroes as Charlie and his friends drive through the tunnel in Perks of Being a Wallflower for the final time. Coming-of-age films and literature hold a very special place in our hearts and often connect us to moments of our own teenage selves. You know, those parts of ourselves that kind of linger inside, just hanging out, always feeling a little emotional. So for author Hilda Hinton, I wonder what song she would choose to represent her character Susie as she figures out the world around her. Hilda's debut novel is titled The Loudness of Unsaid Things, a story of loneliness, isolation and finding your way. So she's actually the perfect guest for our times. Welcome to the drawing room.
Thanks for having me, Patricia.
I want to start by going back in time if we can. Can you take me back to the 1980s in Australia through the eyes of a child?
Yeah, well, it was a different time. Parents weren't living vicariously through us and we were able to roam the streets and just get home by dark. That was a standard rule, or by the time the street lights came on anyway, that was our signal to head home. And other than that, we roamed the streets and explored drains and things we shouldn't. We swung on swings and, you know, hit fences with sticks and hung out together, developed our friendships and conversation and found our moral compass through each other.
You have said that The Loudness of Unsaid Things is an autobiographical fiction. So I wonder if this time in history holds particular significance in your own life.
Well, definitely. I was a 70s kid, sort of teenager in the 80s. I'm definitely representing my era well, I think. And it was just such a fond time for me, despite all the sort of life getting lifed from time to time.
Can you tell me about your upbringing and your family?
I was a bit older than my brother and sister. We lived with our dad. He was a single dad and was the primary caregiver. And every second weekend I'd go and visit my mother, whether she was in a mental institution, which I used to call the Mind Hospital, or whether she was in a housing commission flat. Sort of day-to-day life with Dad was just full of imagination and stories and, you know, we'd write stories and read stories and play board games and puzzles because we weren't allowed to have a TV. Rode our bikes and I had a little brother and sister to be my audience and watch me skate up and down the street and so on. So day-to-day life with Dad was sort of idyllic, and visiting Mum had its complications. She had a variety of mental illnesses. Dad sort of brought us up. We weren't allowed to be embarrassed by each other. We weren't allowed to be bored. There were just certain things that we had to assess. So I was glad he sort of brought us up not to be embarrassed by each other, because it allowed me to experience my mum's sort of varying moods and behaviours, you know, as though it was a bit magical, really, rather than sort of sad or traumatic.
How did he talk to you about your mother's issues? Was he really honest and upfront about what was happening?
Well, given how honest and upfront we've all been about everything, this was the one area we just didn't discuss. And it's part of the reason for my title, because I think because it wasn't talked about, it was just an elephant in the room, just this sort of growing pile of unsaid things. And I didn't know whether I should talk about it. I suppose if I had, he would have been fine. I felt that I did that side of my life on my own, in isolation from the family. Yeah, so
were you trying to protect him from those conversations as well?
I remember wanting to protect my siblings more than Dad. They were little and didn't sort of come to visit with me. I felt that I was protecting them from the worst side of it. I just didn't really discuss it with Dad until well into my 20s.
Did you talk about it with your siblings later? What kind of conversations have you had?
Yeah, similarly, it just seemed to be the one thing that was off the table. And it wasn't until I actually heard my brother reading a letter to his mother on radio that I realised he wrote a letter about searching for this mythical mother that was never spoken about. And it really wasn't until then that I thought it was high time we had a chat. Yeah.
You thought, given he's on radio talking about this, he might be ready.
Yeah. But it was interesting hearing it from his perspective, because he had to go searching in different ways. You know, he found some old poems she'd written and sort of foraging through family history, figured it out on his own. And when he read my book, he said that's when he truly got to know his mother. I guess it's all out on the table now.
Yeah, the book does deal with some pretty heart-wrenching yet quite beautiful moments as Susie wanders through the world. I wonder, again, making that connection to your own life, were you ever privy to information you felt only adults were meant to understand?
I felt overexposed in some ways. Walking around Royal Park mental institution was an adult experience, I think, for a young girl to be wandering the halls there alone. I certainly felt the sort of weight of the adult world coming in. But mainly I watched adults sitting over the way having chats about my progress or what I might be going through, rather than anyone addressing anything with me. I didn't quite understand why everybody sort of felt they had to go off and talk about things and not involve the person they were talking about. It was very strange.
You spent time, as you've just mentioned, as a child visiting specific institutions, caring for your mum, much like Susie's experiences in your book. How did you perceive those places as a child compared to as an adult researching those places for writing purposes?
Well, in hindsight, I feel really privileged. You know, I felt it really shaped me. I got to look at the world from an angle you don't normally see. When you're a child watching, unhinged sort of adults, but also adults at their truest, being themselves in a way that sort of your general grown-up walking down the street would never portray their inner self at all. So I really appreciated it as a child and sort of saw it as this mythical place on top of the faraway tree. Whereas when you're an adult looking at the institutions, it's a very, very different feeling. Much more sadness involved when you're an adult. But when you're a child, it's quite sort of magical and whimsical.
On RN, you're in the drawing room with me, Patricia Carvelis, and my guest tonight is Hilda Hinton. We have been discussing, of course, her life, the 1980s, the very different days of parenting back then, and understanding the world through children's eyes or teenage eyes. Her debut novel is called The Loudness of Unsaid Things. Hilda, how did you blur the lines between fact or real life and fiction in trying to piece this story together?
Well, I took my memories, which weren't plentiful. If I was doing a factual account, it would barely be 20 pages, I think. So what I did was I just remembered all the feelings and just filled in the blanks, very much sort of superimposing fiction onto real structure. But I particularly delighted in the teenage years represented in the book, because I still to this day have very vivid recollections of what it's like being a teenager, whereas I think a lot of adults forget what it was like. So I was able to really come into my own in those sections.
What is it about those years that stays with us? You say maybe different to other adults, but I reckon, I don't know. I mean, I think it is quite a pivotal, life-changing phase of people's lives that does stay with us.
Yeah, well, it's the sort of extremities of emotions and this absolute belief that the world needs to get used to you because you're in it now and you're a part of it and you darn well better get used to me. And, you know, you've got zero risk assessment tools. So your decision-making's terribly poor, but it's usually quite adventurous and fun. I mean, I just think it's a risk for every teenager. I mean, you can just sort of end up hurt or in jail or, you know, all sorts of things can go wrong because your decision-making's so poor. But at the same time, you've just got that glorious ownership of the world.
How have those memories being so strong for you guided you in your own parenting?
Yeah, interesting, because definitely the teenage years have been my favourite part of parenting. I much preferred that to the younger stage.
It's funny, so many people would probably say the opposite, wouldn't they? That teenagers are a nightmare and how can we possibly spend any time with them? Why? Have you just been blessed with amazing teenagers? Why has it been different for you?
Well, I think it's also been constant. So my sister had a falling out with Dad when she was about 14 and came to live with me. A lot of her friends had come and stay for a while they were mending their relationships with their parents for whatever, you know, whatever real or perceived issues there were there. So we jokingly called it the house for the temporarily defeated. So all Connie's friends came through, and then my kids got a bit older and all their kids, all their friends have been coming through. And so I think I think it's my favourite because I've done it for so long. It's something I'm used to, and I like having young people around.
Now, Hilda, you actually come from a pretty well-known family. You are the dedicated big sister to Connie and Samuel Johnson, who some may know through the Love Your Sister Foundation, and Sam riding a unicycle around the country. Yeah. This book exposes a little of your family history. Was it an outlet for you?
It was a great outlet for me. I mean, the character in the book's an only child, so it was very much my journey. As a family, we've been very close. We've done everything together. Connie and Sam particularly Sam, are very public. Yeah, they're very public figures. But I was always there in the engine room behind them. Yeah, sort of taking that ride with them.
How does it feel now to be in the public sphere?
It doesn't really feel like I am. I mean, I suppose I've been out on the road with Love Your Sister last year for about 20 weeks. In the caravans, doing fundraising in a wide variety of local communities. So I guess that's where it all started. But it's been terrific, and I've been very warmly welcomed by the Love Your Sister villagers. I hope that sort of the book I've written, which really is an exploration of the tentacles of mental illness and how it affects the people around, the unwell people. And I think it's an important story, and I'm hoping it opens some discussion.
I believe it was Sam, your brother, who forced your hand to start writing after roughly 20 years. What's that story?
Yeah. Oh gosh. I mean, I've been writing my whole life, really, and I had 20 years off, where family responsibilities and work and all those sort of things came to the forefront. And it was actually after my sister passed away. We were just sitting on the back porch, which is the same porch where Love Your Sister was born. And, so many things have happened on that porch. He basically squared up and said, you've got all this time now. You know, there's no more family crises. The kids are grown. There's nothing to see there. You're hiding behind obligation, and get off your bum and write the book you were always going to write, because now's the time. And I'm like, I'm working, and I'll do it after work, that sort of thing. Within about 5 minutes, I was completely convinced that I was the only thing stopping me. So I appreciated his leg up, so to speak. And for anybody out there who's thinking about, that one niggly thing they've always wanted to do, it really is just about taking a chance and throwing yourself at it. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But not trying is way worse.
But the thing you wanted to do is no doubt very emotional. Did you find it triggering or difficult to write about?
I found it quite cathartic, actually. I feel a lot better about everything since writing it. And I felt it really made me address all my previous thoughts and theories on what had happened in my life and how it had happened. Yeah, I feel very free. Yeah, I just didn't hold back, because that had to be part of it. If I was going to hold anything back, it never would have worked.
I'm sure lots of people can relate to the things left unsaid in families and how they ring louder as time goes by. That's what they do. They become rather loud in your own head. Why do you feel this is something we do?
Oh, I think it's a little bit, I think we're lazy. I think, we'll try to start a conversation with somebody, and if it doesn't go well, we don't try a different communication style or bring it up a week later after everyone's had a breath. We just stop. We don't bother, and we push it aside. So I think we need to be a bit more courageous and a little bit more patient, and take the time, put it out there, get it out there. If it doesn't work the first time, try it a different way, because you've got nothing to lose. It only improves relationships.
Obviously, mental health has had a profound influence on your personal story and your writing. Do you feel releasing this story, sharing this story, putting it out in the world, will hopefully open up some of those kinds of difficult conversations in families?
Yeah, I really hope so, because I sort of grew up in the time where it was all swept under the carpet and no one spoke about it. You know, you didn't speak about the person who was unwell publicly or even within the family. And I think it's terrific. We've come a long way. We're always talking about sort of mental health issues, and you've got Beyond Blue and Lifeline, and you know it's being discussed, but nobody's really discussing what it's like to be the child of, or the sister of, or the mother of, and just the effect that it has in the broader family. I think there's a lot of people out there who would like to talk about it and feel that they're not alone.
There's a lot of loneliness involved when you're in that situation, isn't there?
There is. And there's also a sense of helplessness. You know, you're not sure whether you're not sure what the right thing to do is and whether you should do anything. I mean, I've had a few family members. Sam's had a very public battle with mental health. You know, and you go through those days, if you can't get somebody on the phone, you worry so much. So it can be a bit lonely and it can be a bit stressful. You know, we keep soldiering on and just wait. They always come to you in the end. You know, they always pick up the phone eventually and find somebody to talk to about it. You're not alone.
No, you're certainly not. Before I let you go, have you thought of the song that might accompany Susie's story?
Susie was very much into that sort of gender bender era in the 80s, and she preferred Marilyn to Boy George.
Oh.
And I think he had a one hit. Yeah, it was
I hear
one
you
hit
on the radio.
Yes, calling
How good is so, that song?
Yeah. So that'd be the song.
Marilyn over Boy George. I love how you did that, Hilda. You just smashed that out of the park. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Patricia.
Thank you so much for taking the time to share your story too. And that debut novel by Hilda Hinton is called The Loudness of Unsaid Things. And if this story has raised any issues for you, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14 or Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36. That's 1300 22 46 36. And that's it for RN Drive for tonight. Thank you so much for your company. I'll be back on your radio tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Catch you then.